This is The Guardian.
Wie kann man Risiko im Leben reduzieren? Einen Helm tragen, fit bleiben und die Freunde meiden, die verrückte Ideen hatten. Und beim Investieren? Hier sollte man diversifizieren. Wenn du in einen iShares ETF investierst, kaufst du in einem Schritt einen Teil von Hunderten oder Tausenden von Unternehmen. So musst du dir keine Sorgen mehr machen. Du kannst dir stattdessen lieber Gedanken darüber machen, wer die Fotos von der wilden Nacht mit deinen Freunden gemacht hat. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Eine neue Form der Effizienz mit Asana. Automatisieren Sie Workflows, damit Ihr Team in weniger Zeit mehr erreichen kann. Kostenlos testen unter asana.com.
I will act with historic speed and strength and fix every single crisis facing our country. We have to do it. We're not going to have a country left.
We have a special relationship with the United States. It doesn't matter who's in the White House or number 10. And we look forward to working with Donald Trump over the next 4 years.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Hello, Kieran and I are in the broom cupboard once again, and I've spent quite a lot of time the last few days, given it's Donald Trump's inauguration day, thinking about previous visits to the United States and some of the locations where this huge event will be taking place at 5 o'clock today or noon in Washington, D.C., when Donald J. Trump is inaugurated as the 47th president of the United States. Now, Kieran, you were a Washington correspondent for four years.
I was
during
there.
Trump Mark One.
I did 2 years of Trump Mark One, and then I did the Biden inauguration.
So you've done an inauguration before. Obviously, that was different because it was outside. Huge crowd, we should say.
Big crowd. It was freezing, though. I mean, Donald Trump has moved this inauguration inside the Capitol building, which actually, I have to confess, I didn't realize was a possibility. But it is going to be about -5, I think, today in Washington, D.C. It is a long ceremony and you have to basically wait there all day. And it's not even the people on the kind of dais at the top. It's all the people who queue up and will just spend hours and hours and hours on the Mall in the absolute biting cold.
Yeah, and even hand warmers and sort of, earmuffs and
last time around, I was trying to remember what temperature it was. It was close to zero, but I don't think it was below zero. But do you remember the picture of Bernie Sanders wearing those enormous woolen gloves?
They were like oven gloves, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. He looked like the only warm person at the entire inauguration.
The only sensible person at the entire inauguration.
And then became a meme because of that.
We'll have to keep our eyes open today. They're slightly different, as you say, because it'll be inside. And it's going to be in the Rotunda on Capitol Hill, isn't it? Which is that sort of domed room right at the top of Congress, which I visited for the first time, actually, the Rotunda, that is, when I was in Washington with Keir Starmer on his first foreign trip as Prime Minister when he went over for NATO, the NATO summit. And he also went to the White House. We went with him, went into the Oval Office when he met Joe Biden, which was obviously really fascinating. And the Rotunda is a beautiful room, that dome, that lofty dome, and the sort of the intricate marble carvings all the way around the inside. And there's these big windows at the top, which just sort of, shaft of sunlight can come down and sort of catch off the frieze of modern American history that goes all the way around the walls. It is an incredible room, and you can see why they've picked that, not just for the grandeur, but for the history and the sort of the attachment to American democracy.
Talking about the Rotunda, the equivalent here would be, the closest thing we have is something like Central Lobby. It would be like doing, for those who know Westminster.
Maybe
Westminster Hall in terms of size, but just that kind of sense of being in the center of the building and the dome and the height of the ceiling and the way the light falls in. And actually, the inauguration, the closest we have in terms of ceremony is probably the crowning of the new monarch. That's the way in which Americans, that's how seriously Americans
take this. Oh, you imagine Trump with his attachment to British royalty. Well, might quite like that comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. And he'll probably love being in that building, although it does deny him the chance to boast about the size of the crowds.
which of course he did last time, didn't he, when he was inaugurated 8 years ago and said that it was the biggest crowd ever.
Even though there were pictures showing that it clearly wasn't.
But when he comes in, he's the incoming president has promised to fix every single crisis facing the US in his second term in office. And it's certainly the case that he and the team around him have much more experience of how you need to pull the levers of power. He obviously also has control over all three parts of the American political process in terms of the Senate and the House of Representatives, as well as the White House. So certainly in the first 2 years ahead of the midterms, he's going to have quite a lot of power. And he's expected to sign more than 100 executive orders in the first few days, instantly rewriting many of Joe Biden's policies. Now, we've obviously, I think we've all learned, in not just in British politics, but in global politics, that you can't, it's very hard to make predictions. And so even on that day, back on the storming of the Capitol and the riots there, when I thought that was, you know, the end of it for Trump, but there was no way he was going to have a comeback in future, I probably should have known better, because of course, things change very, very fast. But for him to be so in the ascendancy now, even though he really won actually quite a narrow share of the popular vote. He did win the popular vote, we should say. And yet he seems to have been accepted right across the board in the States now, doesn't he? Even by his political enemies, you know, saying, well, we need to work with him. This is about America first. You know, we need to put the country's interest, the national interest first, even though presumably many of them are, you know, feeling very angry and bitter inside.
Yeah, it's a really interesting contrast with Trump's first term. There was a feeling of, well, the establishment had to try and stop him doing what he wanted to do. It was an anomaly that he'd been elected. It was viewed basically as a mistake. And America had to survive this period of 4 years without too much damage being done. And that was reflected. I mean, that view was true of senior Republicans around the president. So people like Reince Priebus, his first chief of staff, later admitted that they would take pieces of paper off Trump's desk so that he never got to see them, you know, policy suggestions, because he might actually agree to something quite mad. This time around, it feels very different, partially because Trump now has a lot of much closer allies around him. So he's not coming in with the Republican establishment as his Praetorian Guard. He's coming in with his own MAGA people. His takeover of the Republican Party has been complete and absolute. So there is no Republican Party really anymore to stand up to him in the way that it was able to do 8 years ago. And I think that the machinery of government now has realized, look, we're going to have to work with this guy. He's been at the top or thereabouts of American politics and will have been by the end of this period for 12 years. And you have to kind of respect that.
That will be very difficult for some elements of the US establishment, notably the security services, who know from experience that if they pass on information from other governments, for example, it can be shared publicly by him, or even worse, shared directly with, for example, somebody like Vladimir Putin in a bilat. And all of that feeds into this sort of nervousness that exists here in the UK around inside government about Trump's arrival, about what it will mean, not just for one of our closest allies in the States, but also on global affairs and more directly on what it means for us here. And there's been a lot of talk about how Trump's unpredictability is actually a good thing because, you know, he's a strong man of the world and actually he wants to resolve conflicts. And because he's unpredictable, the West's foes find it very difficult to second guess what moves he will take next, or what he will do if they don't deliver on his side, on their side of the deal, as he likes to put it. And, you know, I suppose to a certain extent that might be true, but what I've really noticed in the 8 years since he was first elected is what has actually happened is that precisely because of that unpredictability and that sort of lack of knowledge about where he's going to go next, what's happened is that groups of countries have formed alliances of their own that they think that they can rely on. Whether that has meant that sort of like there's a bolstering of, the obvious one is sort of, you know, European states. Yeah. Or if you look at some of the alliances that have started to spring up in the Middle East, or for example, the BRICS countries, which are Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, and how they're sort of becoming a power base now as well. You know, this is sort of the reaction rather than just sitting waiting to see what they're going to do. Yeah. And I think in terms of the US's allies, there's a problem in that it undermines their resolve. It makes them feel less bolstered by what we've always regarded as being, you know, American support, unstintingly, unquestionably, that the US would be on our side in these things. And I think that's the downside, if you like, of the uncertainty of what Trump's going to do.
And you know, item one, or close to item one, on the agenda between the two countries really encapsulates that, because it's about the Chagos Islands. Now, I don't for a moment think that Donald Trump cares deeply about the Chagos Islands, nor do I think he probably heard of them about a year ago. But this is exactly the kind of issue which can flare up during a Trump presidency. The American establishment, the American civil service, wants this deal to go ahead. But there are elements of Trump world that don't want the deal to go ahead, egged on, I should say, by Nigel Farage and kind of that group of reform people who've got close to Trump. And it's completely unclear. Trump has said nothing about this, and it's very unclear which way he's going to go. And when he comes into power, he will be pressured by his security chiefs. They'll come in and they'll say, look, these are all the reasons that we think this deal is a good idea. But then he'll have other people in his other ear saying, no, it lets China in. And that kind of message does sell well for Trump. But this will happen again and again and again, where we think, oh, we've sorted something out, it's all done and dusted, and then suddenly someone in Trump world takes a dislike to it. And if they manage to get the president's ear, then they can persuade him to do things that you wouldn't have expected.
And the two big areas, the sort of backdrops to all of this, are, of course, trade and defence. The Chagos deal is part of the sort of the bigger defence security picture. It is inevitable we'll see Trump put more pressure on Britain and other NATO allies to invest more in NATO. We are expecting in our spending review here in June the government to highlight defence spending, to prioritise defence spending because of the pressure from Trump and, of course, the sort of the broader backdrop of the sort of very turbulent world we're living in at the moment. And then on trade, the uncertainties about what he's going to do there. What we do know, though, is that Britain isn't a priority, right? For all we like to think about us being their closest ally and the special relationship and, you know, Prime Minister after Prime Minister bangs on about it. Yeah. When Trump comes in, his priority is going to be China and the trading relationship there. Yeah. They're going to be his immediate borders. So Mexico to the south and Canada to the north, both on trade and particularly with Mexico over border flows and migration. Yeah. And when it comes to sort of further afield, it's going to be Ukraine and Iran. And Britain's going to be kind of like not bottom of the list, but all the sort of the flurry of energy and excitement in Downing Street about arranging a trip over to see Trump in the White House as soon as possible after inauguration. You know, they're now sort of saying, well, look, you know, we're established, long-term established allies. We had this great dinner with him, with Keir Starmer and David Lammy back in the autumn. It's a strong relationship. We talk often. We don't need to rush over there. I mean, kind of like, I think, slightly sort of hiding the fact that we're not Trump's priority. And for all the sentimentality that he obviously feels towards the UK, you know, the royal family, Scotland, where his mum came from, the fact that it's sort of, you know, the mothership of the English language, all that sort of stuff. He is a deal maker. He will be thinking about it through the prism of American interests globally. And Britain comes quite far down that list. That's not necessarily a bad thing, though. I don't think we should necessarily be too worried about that, because if we're not in the firing line, then we're not in the firing line, you know, and it gives us a bit more time to prepare and sort of to work out what actually is a priority for him.
Look, if any of our listeners read a piece that says Downing Street is relaxed about not going to see Trump early on in his presidency, that is not correct.
Yes.
that is wrong. They might be saying that now, but probably about a week ago, I was talking to someone in Number 10 who said, we've got to get there as soon as possible. And I said, well, are you going to wait for Peter Mandelson to get in as
the new ambassador?
And they said, no, we don't have to wait for that. We just need to get there fast. So that's what they were saying a week or so ago. If they've changed their tune, I think that tells you that the reality has changed. By the way, Peter Mandelson, should we talk about him? I mean, I always found that a surprising appointment. Despite Downing Street's insistence that Peter Mandelson is a political heavyweight who can navigate his way around any complex political setup, he is exactly the kind of guy that Trump world doesn't tend to like. He's a political professional. He has deep ties to the political establishment. Of course, he helped get Tony Blair to power in 1997. He then became an MP and then a member of the House of Lords. He was EU commissioner. He is definitely of the centre-left. And on top of that, his company has represented Chinese clients, and he's defended China in the past and criticized Trump for levying tariffs on China. For all these reasons, I think it is going to be a difficult appointment. I don't quite buy this idea that Trump's going to veto it. I just think Trump's got too much
on his
plate.
Even one of his aides, senior aides, described him as an absolute moron.
It described Mandelson as an absolute moron. That sounds very Trumpy, doesn't it, in language? Peter Mandelson might be a lot of things. I don't think he's an absolute moron.
No.
But it's really interesting. And we know by now that Karen Pierce, the existing ambassador, wanted to stay in place. I was in DC when she turned up. And Karen Pierce is quite the character. She's very famous for giving lavish parties. She turned up in Washington.
I've been to one in the ambassador's residence in Washington.
They're great, aren't they?
Champagne flowing.
Absolutely.
British taxpayer-funded champagne, I'll have you know.
Well, yeah. Of course, that's all important diplomacy. But when she turned up in Washington, it was the middle of COVID. So she wasn't really able to hold these parties. So she used to invite select groups of people round, and we'd sit outside under these kind of gas burners, and the champagne would go around and the canapes would go around, and then people would kind of gradually huddle a little bit closer together. But she was fantastic at making those connections, even when nobody else was really meeting in person. She'd find ways to make those connections happen. She also has a fantastic memory for names. She was always very good at remembering who people were, even when she seemed to have had several glasses of champagne herself. And she's respected by Donald Trump himself and Trump world more generally. So it always seems surprising to me, why not just let her stay?
So whilst Karen Pearce will be representing the UK at the inauguration, no ministers or indeed the Prime Minister will be there. This is not, as some have suggested, some big drama and some big fallout. There hasn't been a British Prime Minister or Foreign Minister representing the UK at a US presidential inauguration. I'm not reluctant to say ever, but certainly not in many, many, many decades. There's no recent precedent to it. One British politician who will be there is, of course, Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, who has been taking every opportunity available to appear on the British media, just to point out that he's there. He's been given tickets to the inauguration by someone in Mar-a-Lago, and he will be going along. We don't yet know where he's going to be sitting. Is he going to be like in the front row or way up in the gods? We'll have to wait and see. He, of course, makes much of his close friendship and relationship, not just with Trump, but with some of Trump's incoming cabinet. While there clearly is a relationship there, I think we should take it with little pinch of salt in terms of how close that they actually are and how much access and time he gets with him. But nevertheless, he will be there and shouting about it. Do you think he'll be bolstered by Trump?
Yeah, because it will give him visibility. I mean, Nigel Farage is able to get publicity at any time almost, but this gives him a level of visibility, I think, his relationship with Trump, and a credibility. We'll need to listen to him, and I think rightly so, because there aren't that many British politicians who genuinely have long-standing ties to Trump. Now, obviously, he exaggerates those ties, and I don't think he sees him as much as he claims. But it is nevertheless the case.
He's in the States quite a lot, though, isn't he?
He's in the States
a lot. He's elected as MP for Clacton. He's been there every month.
There is a group of kind of people around Nigel Farage and people he knows who've managed to get their way really into the heart of Republican politics. The thing is, Farage has been there long enough. He knows the ways through to the president.
Yeah. Now, I spent much of this weekend, Kieran, glued to my Guardian app and other news sources. Other news sources are available, looking at what was the events unfolding in the Middle East. And after sort of a stuttering start, how the ceasefire finally came in Gaza, and three Israeli hostages, including a British Israeli, and 90 Palestinian prisoners were released as part of this deal between Hamas and Israel. Very emotional scenes playing out on the ground, both with the families of those three individuals that have been released. They were obviously taken hostage in those awful attacks 15 months ago on October the 7th, when Hamas launched into Israel and killed more than 1,000 people and kidnapped hundreds. And also emotional scenes from the families of those who still remain hostage. But more than that, there was images being sent out of Gaza for the first time of what northern Gaza looks like, and how what was a sort of a busy, bustling city has been reduced to a pile of concrete rubble. And despite that, people are coming home. People who've been in refugee camps elsewhere in the Gaza Strip are coming home to, you know, these piles of rubble, which they still regard, you know, they still regard as their home. And the very poignant and striking moments when they return, and for the first time, they've woken up this morning without a broken night's sleep because of incoming fire, as well as indeed outgoing fire. So it does feel like a moment of hope, and it should be recognised as that. But I also really fear that once we get beyond the first 2 weeks, when the Israeli government needs to pick up again negotiations with Hamas about what then follows, stage two of this three-stage plan, stage one being release of hostages and prisoners, stage two being trying to bring an end to the conflict, and stage three being a sort of a rebuilding of Gaza. But when they get to stage two, that'll all fall apart again because it's just too hard.
Maybe. I actually think that stage three is going to be the hardest of all of those. I think in a way, the fact that the ceasefire came in and is now appears
temporary
to be...
Temporary ceasefire,
yeah. But it does appear to be holding. The biggest hurdle to that was always likely to be, I think, Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, getting it through the Israeli cabinet.
And Hamas, to be fair, they were resisting it as well.
Yes, although I think Hamas was pretty much signed up to the deal last May when it was first suggested. The greater difficulty seemed to be that there are factions within the Israeli cabinet, particularly on the far right, that just said explicitly, we will not accept a ceasefire unless Hamas has been totally destroyed, like you promised us in the government. And clearly Hamas is not destroyed. I mean, you saw when those hostages were handed over, images of Hamas fighters standing with their weapons raised. I mean, there was what greater symbol of you have not destroyed us could there be? Now, there was a resignation from the Israeli cabinet, but the whole plan has not fallen apart. And I think that was a key test. And the fact that the cabinet did vote for this gives me personally some hope that there could be a longer lasting peace.
Yeah.
I just wonder how on earth you begin to rebuild a territory that has been so completely leveled.
Well, I hope we get to the point where we can actually see, and maybe because of the sort of the change in power in the States, I mean, the ceasefire deal is one which Joe Biden has been working on for a very long time, but there is no doubt that any deal needs a deadline, and Trump's inauguration was going to be that deadline. So his arrival, with everything that brings, was a sort of a focus point for both Hamas and the peace brokers in the Middle East in the form of the UAE and Qatar, but also, as you say, for Netanyahu and the Israeli cabinet. So it'll be crucial to see now what he then does to try and push this process forward.
It might just be worth very quickly reflecting on how this has played out in the UK, and it's obviously caused ructions here in Westminster. It's also, I think, played out among voters in an unusual way, and perhaps one that we couldn't have predicted, which is a lot of people have got their news, especially younger people, have got their news about this conflict from social media, from TikTok and Instagram. A lot of video content from Gaza has gone viral and has really struck a chord among younger voters. And I think you're going to have this group of voters who maybe are more hostile to Israel than generations previously, and are also less trusting of governments of both main parties. And maybe we should be self-reflective here as well, maybe of mainstream media outlets like ours as well. There has been a whole other information ecosystem regarding this conflict that has played out mostly below the radar.
Yeah, and that's a challenge actually to the mainstream media organizations like The Guardian on a much deeper level as well, much broader level, I should say, as well. It's not just about what's been going on in the Gaza conflict. It's about, where people get their news from now. And in a world where, there's such skepticism of establishment, whether that's politics, whether that's business, whether that's the media, how those established institutions deal with that, engage with that, and sort of challenge some of the misinformation that sort of does the rounds on social media.
Perhaps this isn't the week to talk about Westminster politics very much, given that all eyes are on Washington and the Middle East, but the government is still doing things. And it's worth, I think, just watching what happens with Rachel Reeves. She's flying out to Davos. She's hosting a series of meetings with investors, top hedge fund and private equity people, including, we're told, Americans who backed Donald Trump during the election. She'll fly home and presumably make a statement to the Commons or perhaps even some kind of speech afterwards. This is all part of the government's desperate attempt to drum up investment for British infrastructure and to get growth going again. But it's worth reflecting, and The Observer, our colleagues at The Observer, did a very good piece about this at the weekend. After this time last week, when we were talking about, is Rachel Reeves going to get the sack? Actually ended last week on quite a positive note. Did a good performance.
A week's a long time in politics.
Absolutely. Good performance in the Commons, some good economic data, and she flies out to Davos on a relative high, which I didn't think we would be saying this time last week.
Well, there we go. Things change fast. But that's all from us this week. Kieran and I and the team would love to hear from you. We've got a new email, so do send us your questions and thoughts to politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. That's politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. We'll be pouring through your messages.
And also, if you have any questions, any burning issue you've been wanting to ask us about Westminster politics, whether it's factual or for our opinions on things, we'll do our best to answer them in the podcast.
Absolutely. And please also like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday.
And tomorrow, that's Tuesday, is the deadline to vote for us in the in-house Political Podcast Awards People's Choice category. If you enjoy listening to us and John Harris every week, please do think about voting for us. You can go to politicalpodcastawards.co.uk/the-people's-choice-awards. So that's politicalpodcastawards.co.uk/the-people's-choice-award, all with dashes in between. And we'll put the link in our show notes as well, just in case you forget that.
That's quite the mouthful, but as Kieran says, the link will be in our show notes. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
With social media bosses firing their fact-checkers or openly campaigning for the far right, if you want to understand this moment in the world, not through platforms owned by some billionaire, but through people on the ground working to arrive at the truth, listen to Today in Focus from The Guardian every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Guardian.
Wie kann man Risiko im Leben reduzieren? Einen Helm tragen, fit bleiben und die Freunde meiden, die verrückte Ideen hatten. Und beim Investieren? Hier sollte man diversifizieren. Wenn du in einen iShares ETF investierst, kaufst du in einem Schritt einen Teil von Hunderten oder Tausenden von Unternehmen. So musst du dir keine Sorgen mehr machen. Du kannst dir stattdessen lieber Gedanken darüber machen, wer die Fotos von der wilden Nacht mit deinen Freunden gemacht hat. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.